Hello and welcome to Food Talk Radio for the month of August 2013. We're coming to you from the campus of Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. Summer's in full swing here in the Green Mountain State, and after a soggy start to the summer months, the fields are full with the sights and sounds of farming. Our episode today is going to be all about farming and all the policies and practices that go along with it. Jack Hornicle is going to sit down with friend of the show, VLS Professor Pamela Vesseland, to have a conversation about animals and agriculture and the new legal attempts to protect them. After that, Robin Kundis Craig, a distinguished summer scholar here at Vermont Law School, presents her research on aquaculture and its potential in achieving food security. Finally, pasture program coordinator for the University of Vermont Extension, Jen Colby, is going to explain the key concepts of good grazing. And Jack follows up with friend of the show, David Ainsworth, to see how this South Royalton farmer grazes his dairy herd. But, as always, we'll start by turning to Emily Lyons for the latest on the Farm Bill. Here's Emily with Farm Bill Watch.
Hello, everyone. Here's another update on the Farm Bill. After the embarrassing failure to pass a Farm Bill last month, on July 11th, the House of Representatives passed a modified version of the bill that did not include authorization for food stamps and nutrition programs. The bill narrowly passed with a vote of 216 to 208, with all of the House Democrats voting against it. The following week, the House of Representatives sent their partial bill to the Senate. The Senate accepted in a unanimous consent resolution to send the Farm Bill back to the House. This procedural move allows the House and Senate leaders to hold a conference to work out the differences in the two versions. The House is currently deciding how to move forward with the Farm Bill. It is unclear at this point in time if the House will attempt to pass a nutrition title before sending the bill to conference or move forward to conference with the Senate without the nutrition title. In order to assist moving the bill to conference, Senate Agriculture Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell announced the 7 Democrats and 5 Republican senators chosen for the conference committee. The 7 Democrats represent large ag-producing states from the Midwest, West, and Northeast, while the 5 Republicans represent mainly Southern and Midwestern states. House of Agriculture Committee Chairman Frank Lucas has yet to announce the numbers and members of conferees. It is currently unclear when a formal Farm Bill conference will begin, however. It is evident a conference committee will not commence before the August congressional recess. Additionally, the White House has indicated that a Farm Bill lacking the nutrition title or with severe cuts to the program will not be signed. The current extension of the 2008 Farm Bill expires on September 30th. Stay tuned to Food Talk Radio for more developments with the Farm Bill.
I'm here with Pamela Vesseland, professor at Vermont Law School and University of Arkansas Law, to talk about the current state of animal welfare in agriculture.
All right, Jack. Well, thank you. So I think we're in a very interesting time when it comes to legislating to protect animals in agriculture, because we still have very few federal regulations, and the ones that do exist are either under-enforced or, for all intents and purposes, not enforced. The only federal legislation that really addresses animals used for food before they're slaughtered, while they're still alive, is in the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act, which is a law enacted in 1958 that requires that any livestock meat, so that's cattle, hogs, sheep, they have to be, quote, rendered insensible before their slaughter. That means rendered unconscious.
The federal legislation only addresses the animal's welfare immediately before it's killed.
Right, exactly. And in the absence of federal legislation, a number of states have begun to enact protections. The most active state is, of course, California, just as they've led the way in environmental legislation. Back in 2008, Californians voted to support a proposition that directed the California legislature to enact standards, humane standards, for the treatment of animals raised for food in California. More people voted for that in California than voted for Obama in his first term. It was an astounding victory for animal protection legislation and the first state law that the state legislature enacted is famously called the California Egg Bill, which bans the use of battery cages for laying hens. If you're not familiar with battery cages, They are small cages that keep 4 to 6 hens, laying hens, together. Each hen has about the space of, well, less than the size of an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. So there's no chance to open their wings or move around. It's a highly stressful environment. California is going to ban those. If they stopped there, that would be what other states have started to do. But California went one step further and decided that they would help protect their own egg producers from competition from out of state. Those eggs would be sold at a cheaper price than Californian eggs. So California legislature said that they also would ban the sale of any eggs produced using the battery cage method. Well, that's not going to take effect until 2015. It's going to be a big legal challenge if we get that far, because now you've got, what, 38 million people living in California. It's a lot of egg consumers. It's the biggest egg producing state in the nation. And it's starting to really push, it's pushing the industry, and it has pushed certain members of Congress into trying to enact legislation that would preempt all state animal welfare protections for farmed animals. In fact, the current farm bill that's adopted by the House of Representatives includes a different provision, which has very broad sweeping effects on animal welfare laws in all the states that are trying to raise standards for farm animals. It basically just would preempt any state regulation having to do with agricultural production method. The language is so broad that it could apply to pretty much any kind of state environmental, animal welfare regulation, maybe even labor, worker safety regulation.
So do you think that amendment would frustrate the state's efforts to improve animal welfare on their own?
Oh, yeah. On day one, it would nullify all state laws that have either banned or phased out veal crates, battery cages, and foie gras, and gestation crates. This is a classic federalism question. Which side is best equipped and should be regulating the welfare of animals that we use for food? Almost all other animal cruelty statutes. These are all state laws. These are exercises of state police powers. So it should follow that these are just other animals in the state. That state should be able to dictate how those animals are treated. Now, because these animals typically move in interstate commerce, there are going to be limitations. They wouldn't be able to enact such unreasonable welfare guidelines that it would frustrate the interstate commerce or make it very difficult for producers.
So that's where the California egg bill comes in, because they've, as of 2015, will ban the sale of eggs produced using battery cages, regardless of where that egg came from.
Right, so you can't say that California is discriminating against out-of-state commerce, because they're not. And they're not protecting their own farmers. It's a requirement of any producer. What it will really come down to is whether such a regulation is an inhibitor to interstate commerce.
As I understand it, though, the egg industry is not necessarily in opposition to California's initiative or other states that have banned battery cages. They support it in ways.
Yeah, it's really interesting, Jack, because, I mean, things are changing, right? The industry is catching on. I think the United Egg Producers, which is the largest trade organization that represents something like 95% of the egg producers in the country, they decided that in order to essentially create a level playing field, they made an agreement after some negotiations with the Humane Society to essentially go forward to Congress and find some sponsors to enact a bill that would change that standard at the federal level. When you think about it, that would be the first time we have any federal legislation that says animals in agriculture deserve to be treated with a certain standard of care.
That's not in connection with slaughter.
Not in connection with slaughter.
Just the raising of the animal.
Right.
So maybe a comprehensive plan in the end would be the most beneficial. But at least at this point, what we're looking at is setting the lowest bar.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things where when you read, I don't know, you've said you've read the Farm Bill. There are lots of details in there that reflect a real desire to keep agriculture and industrial agriculture protected from whistleblowers, from advocates for worker safety, food safety, animal welfare. We are living in interesting times. So,
Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A whole bunch of countries around the world are consciously and explicitly turning to mariculture as part of their food security planning. Lots of different circumstances, economic, social, environmental, food security driving this, but it's becoming a worldwide phenomenon. And this is like in the last 5 to 10 years in particular. So there's one point you take away from this lecture and remember forever: mariculture is not all created equal. Okay? I cannot say mariculture good, mariculture bad. I have to ask, what are you doing where and how? Because it matters. What mariculture you are probably familiar with, if you are familiar with any of it, is coastal salmon aquaculture, coastal salmon mariculture. Usually it's Atlantic salmon, which is basically extinct in the wild. A variety of places with cold waters have put in offshore aquaculture pens. And the pens vary, the concentrations vary, but you've got Norway, you've got British Columbia, you've got the Faroe Islands, you've got Scotland, I could throw in Australia, I could throw in Chile. Pretty common, pretty popular, one of the first offshore aquaculture, mariculture endeavors in the world. And it's also the one that got people worried about the environmental impacts of what mariculture could mean. And the impacts are significant. The one I'm going to start with is the fish and fish meal. Salmon are carnivores. Means you have to feed them meat. And the meat they usually get fed are ground up anchovies or sardines taken from the wild and the oil that goes with them. And the math doesn't work. If you care about wild fish at all, the math doesn't work. It takes somewhere between 2.6 pounds to 5 pounds of wild fish to grow 1 pound of farmed salmon. You're not helping. Not helping food security, you're not helping the ocean ecosystem, you're not helping. But there's other things too. Anytime you confine animals in an enclosed location, you gotta be worried about disease. It's true on land, it's true on the ocean. Some of these pens have like 3 million salmon crowded in together. They get dosed with antibiotics. That means you're throwing pharmaceuticals into the open water. It means you're exposing bacteria and other critters that can infect humans and other animals to antibiotics. And they do what bacteria do. They become antibiotic resistant. So that's an issue. You get diseases. Farm salmon are famous for acquiring sea lice, which they're then great at infecting other fish with. You get fish that escape, which if your Atlantic salmon are not native to wherever they're being raised, which they're usually not, you've got an introduced species problem, like with any other introduced species problem. If they're being raised where other species of salmon live, you might have an inbreeding problem too, or interbreeding problem, which if you're talking about the Pacific Northwest, where a lot of the runs of salmon are listed under the Endangered Species Act, that gets to be problematic legally as well as biologically. But the biggest problem people worry about with the farm salmon is the fact that they're kept in those pens. Right, I showed you the pictures. Those pens stay in one place with 3 million salmon swimming around. All the waste collects right on the same bottom, very small. Basically creates mini dead zones, kills the entire bottom ecology. I'm not big on farm salmon, if that hasn't become clear. Alright. But there are other forms of aquaculture and mariculture that are good to know about and good for the environment. So, relatively new, is coral reef aquaculture, mariculture. Technology finally developed, the breeding technology that allows people to grow coral offshore, being used mostly for restoration work, coral restoration work, either because coral got hit with coral bleaching or because they got run over by a cruise ship or whatever. But when you restore coral reefs, you generate fish, one of the most productive ecosystems on the planet. And so that is viewed as a form of food security, mariculture. A little more indirect than some of them, but still works. Plus you get a nice ecosystem back while you're at it. The new one, the one to watch, is truly open ocean mariculture. And this is where I think the future of mariculture is going. I think it's going to be very interesting legally. I think it's going to be very interesting ecologically. So the first really big experiment was the Velella mariculture experiment. This was off the coast of the Big Island of Hawaii. What's different about it, well, okay, first of all, it looks weird. What was different about it is, first of all, it took place in federal waters. This meant it was more than 3 miles offshore where this thing was put in the water, in 12,000 feet of water. So immediately some of the pollution issues are dissipated. It's not staying still, it's not anchored, it's moving around, it's got a radio tracker on it. It's in a whole lot of water, so whatever's coming out of the fish can be diluted fairly easily, fairly fast. Second way they tried to make it environmentally benign, those fish exist in Hawaiian waters regardless. They're not being fed as much. They're certainly not being medicated as much. They are fed, when they are fed, high-protein soy meal, not fish meal. This experiment's been going on since 2010. Had to go through some fairly intensive permitting through the state of Hawaii and through the federal government. And it had some glitches. They lost a couple of them. The radio tracking failed. They got battered by hurricanes, which Hawaii gets. They managed to get the technology down, and the company is Blue Ocean. The fish is trademarked as Kampachi, but it's actually a native species. They're basically a form of yellowtail. The first commercial sales started in May of 2012. The fish are pulled out twice a week. They're only pulled out as demanded. They are sashimi grade, sushi grade fish. They're 5 to 6 pounds when they're harvested. They have been featured in New York gourmet extravaganzas. They've been featured in Hawaiian gourmet extravaganzas. And the company, Blue Ocean, is now making a profit. This is the first open ocean mariculture attempt to become profitable. In November 2012, this company and this project was chosen as one of Time Magazine's best innovations. So, we'll see.
I'm Jenny Colby. I live in East Randolph, just up the road, and I work for the UVM Extension Center for Sustainable Ag, and I coordinate the pasture program. We work with all different kinds of farmers, primarily livestock farmers, to help use their animals and their land and protect their natural resources and make money and stay in business, and because grazing allows you to do all of those things and maintain good quality of life for farmers too. And we've been in business for about 15 years and have overwhelmingly heard from farmers that pasture is a great resource and that it's working. So that's what I'm here about. And then I also raise pigs and sheep and poultry up at our place. I'm a little biased, but I feel like pasture can be the most regenerative agricultural system anywhere. But has to be well managed, and that's where we get to the key concepts. So some of the key concepts that are all on this sheet are to think about the timing of the plants, and one of the most important factors in that is to think about the 3-day rule. Now, The three-day rule is about what happens to plants after they receive a shock. So an animal comes along and tongue or teeth, it bites into a plant, it rips a plant up, one or the other, or both. And the plant goes into a kind of a stasis at that point, and it just stops. And for a period of time, the animals can rebite it without affecting the carbohydrate reserves that are found in the plant's roots. But after about the third day, and sometimes that's a little earlier if we have a really rainy time, after about the third day, the plant begins to regrow. And depending upon where the growing points are, and we've got a little picture, some plants have their growing points at a higher place, and some plants have their growing points at a lower place. That new shoot, that beautiful green shoot, is so tasty, and if they loved it the first time, they love it more the second time because it's even more tender and it's even more wonderful. And each time the animal comes back and starts to bite the plant again, when it's regrowing, it's using those carbohydrate reserves below the soil to force that growth. It can't photosynthesize. It can't use the sun properly. So it's pulling from its reserves. So that is a condition called overgrazing, and it's one of the things that we have to really think about when we're doing a grazing system. Because when we talk about the roots, what you see above and what you see below the soil surface are the same. So if you see a great tall plant, odds are it has very long roots as well. So if that plant gets bitten and bitten and bitten and bitten, the roots will slough away and they'll get really, really short. But if you come along, take the top of the plant, and then let the plant rest, those roots only slough off a little bit, and the plant grows. It grows deeper, and the plant grows taller. You do it again, and the same thing happens, and the plants will become more dense. So a sign of a good grazing system is actually that the plants are getting more dense. The plant spacing is getting closer and closer together. There are a lot of different theories about how to properly graze, so I'm just going to give you some of those key concepts. But one of the things that we talk about is coming into graze at a certain plant height and pulling the animals out at another plant height. And the debating is what is the right height to pull them in and what is the right height to pull them out. So you happen to have an orchard grass and clover mix. Orchard grass and clover are pretty common. So that means that you have between 300 and 350 pounds of dry matter per inch per acre.
Per inch of height.
Per inch of height. Yeah, so if you have 10 inches, then you're looking at between 3,000 and 3,500 pounds of dry matter per acre. That's all of it. That's everything if they ate down to the ground. And that's not what we ever, ever want. And what we typically recommend is that people try not to let their animals graze below 4 inches anyway. Because what ends up happening is multifold. One is the plant doesn't have as much photosynthesizing matter itself, so it's going to have to draw on its root reserves longer. So the other piece about not grazing too low has to do with parasite management, and especially if you're managing goats or sheep. They're really efficient animals, and they're amazing. They can do so much, and they are such a good situation for a small farm. And at the same time, they're highly susceptible to parasites, particularly if they graze over the same ground, and they are re-exposed to the parasite eggs that they themselves have dropped. So grazing a little bit taller and not forcing them down is really good for parasite management, too. All the different animals eat a different amount of dry matter according to their own body weight and their nutritional needs. So if there's an animal that is lactating, whether it's either a dairy cow or an animal that is nursing young animals, a mom was nursing young animals, they have the highest nutritional needs of anybody. So either a dairy cow or a sheep or a goat will often use 3 to 3.5% of its body weight in dry matter, which in grass is just a huge amount because grass is about 85% water. up to 90. So, which is almost the reverse of hay. So hay is about 85% dry matter. So it's just a very large quantity in general to get your head around. That's per day. So that means that, you know, a 100-pound sheep is actually she's only taking in 3.5 pounds of dry matter. So in terms of hay, that's not a huge amount of hay. But when you're talking about going out into the grass and eating that, it's actually a lot more than you would ever imagine, especially if you have to cut it yourself and take it in. It's like, part of this is animal behavior and how animal behavior is impacting the plants and the soil and the reverse. All of this is trying to balance the needs of the animals and the plants with the needs of the human to have a life. So take it with a grain of salt and adapt
every
that.
2 days.
Exactly.
No way.
We hear now from South Royalton dairy farmer David Ainsworth to learn about his grazing practices.
See, this is our little freestyle. They lay down here, and we shut them in here between the bunker and the to go into the parlor and milk, and then they come out that open door when they get milk. So that's how we know if we got them milked or not. Mm-hmm. Our bunker will be filled with corn silage, I hope, filled with corn silage this fall. And then our manure pitch straight away. The cows go down to the end of the bunker and then take a left to go out to pasture, and then we scrape right into the pit with our manure. That's a cement-bottomed pit, and we'll have that filled by the time I get the bunker corn chopped here, 1st of October. I hope to have most of the corn done, and then we'll start unloading the manure pit, hauling it up on the hill to spread on the hay fields up. Because most of my hay fields are up on the hill there. Mm-hmm. Fields you can't cultivate otherwise, so we grow hay on them. And then down here in the valley, I have some corn that we grow.
And so how large is the size of your herd?
We run 45 to 50 milk cows. I have 54 stalls out here, so I'll never get any bigger than that. We run usually about 50 young stock, or thereabouts, depending upon what Mother Nature gives me. Bred heifers are up on the hill in a 60 to 80 acre pasture. Goes around a couple hay fields, and the babies are just out back behind that building over there. I have another pen that I hold about 9 little guys. They're younger ones. They'll be turning one during the winter.
And the 60 to 80 acre pasture, do you have that split up into different sections?
That isn't. It's because it's up on the hill and has a topography varying about 400 or 500 feet and goes around different hay fields and other stuff. It's not broke up. They wander the whole pasture. They do a pretty good job of grazing it down. And I have 3-day pastures we rotate them in, and then 3-night pastures. I can't really break them down any again because they go around, got odd shapes and go around different things. I can't really break them down much more than that, but we rotate them around as much as we can, usually spending 2 or 3 days in each pasture. So that gives the off ones about a week of rest in between.
Mm-hmm. With the amount of land that you're using, do you think your herd could overgraze it, chomp it down too much?
They can. I mean, ideally, I'd really like to have, if I had more grazing land, I would give it more time to rest in between between turning the cows into it. But I just don't have any more land that I can use.
Well, that does it for this episode of Food Talk Radio. Contributions for today's episode were from Will Duane, Jack Hornicle, and Emily Lyons. Our faculty advisor is Lori Restino. Support for this show comes from the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems at Vermont Law School, as well as Royalton Community Radio. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at VT Food Radio, and podcasts of this and every episode are available on iTunes. Today we had music by Onomanaguchi, Moonbounce. Playing us out today is our own Jack Hornicle. Thanks for listening to Food Talk Radio, farm, table, and everything in between.